Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 951. Fascism, 2017 World Tour. This is being recorded on March 23rd of the year 2017. I was intending to have this program be something of an extension of and a development upon For the Record 950. And in particular, I wanted to take a look at some things that have been going on with Bernie Sanders and some of the people he has been, and some of the policies he has been supporting, and some of the people whom he has helped to shoehorn into key positions in the Democratic Party. This against the background, not only of the, quote, shock to the system, unquote, that many in the Trump administration, such as Stephen Bannon, about whom we will speak in a minute, have advocated, but against the background of the fact that Sebastian Gorka, a third-generation Hungarian Nazi, is the Trump administration's point man against, quote, or for counter-jihadism. He is the point man for the Trump administration against Islamic extremism. And with a Hungarian, a third-generation Hungarian Nazi in such a position, and with people like Keith Ellison with one foot in the, he's an African-American Muslim with one foot in the Muslim Brotherhood and another in the Nation of Islam, I think the outrage that many people are going to be experiencing, many of the ignorant people are going to be experiencing when they find out what Trump is really all about, will be directed elsewhere and eclipsed by the shock to the system, because I think we can fairly rely that such a shock will be allowed to go forward. It won't need to be crafted. It will simply be allowed to go forward, and that will serve to divert people's ire and attention from the fact that essentially they are being royally screwed and are going to be royally screwed for a long, long time to come. There is so much going on, and in particular what has happened in the U.S. is or has happened around the world, and we are going to take a look at some elements of commonality. Beginning once again here, yet another influence on Stephen Bannon, not only Trump's campaign manager during the campaign, but his top advisor, the most important member of the National Security Council, and the head of something called the Strategic Initiatives Group, which would appear to be something of a parallel NS, or National Security Council, and featuring, again, the aforementioned Sebastian Gorka, the third-generation Hungarian Nazi, who is in charge of the Trump administration's policy towards Islamic extremism. Yet another influence on Stephen Bannon is a French fascist named Charles, that's C-H-A-R-L-E-S, like the English Charles, Maurras, M-A-U-R-R-A-S. Article about him from Mother Jones of March 16th of 2017. Article by Pema, P-E-M as in Mary A, Levy, capital L-E-V-Y. Stephen Bannon is a fan of a French philosopher who was an anti-Semite and a Nazi supporter. It reads in part, Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist, recently spoke approvingly of the ideas of an anti-Semitic French intellectual who was sentenced to life in prison for cooperating with the Nazis during World War II. In an article on Bannon's interactions with European right-wing nationalists who want to break apart the European Union, Politico reported last week that Bannon has, quote, expressed admiration for the reactionary French philosopher Charles Maurras, according to a French media reports confirmed by Politico. Recent articles in French media claim Bannon favorably cited Marat to a French diplomat, skipping down. But Marat was more than a nationalist. He was an infamous anti-Semite whose anti-Jewish views were central to his outlook. From 1908 to 1944, Marat edited the anti-Semitic paper L'Action Française, the organ of an eponymous movement that was anti-democratic and pro-monarchy. The movement was born out of the Dreyfus Affair, an international controversy in which an innocent Jewish soldier was convicted in 1894 of passing secrets to the Germans, parenthetically that during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, a crime for which he was later exonerated. The movement's, quote, founding prejudice, unquote, was that Dreyfus was in fact guilty and that those who supported him were undermining France. According to Frederick Brown's The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914 to 1940. Marat spent years writing anti-Semitic articles. He referred to the French government, known as the Third Republic, as the Jew state, the Masonic state, the immigrant state, unquote. In 1936, Marat served 8 months in prison for inciting the attempted assassination of Jewish politician Léon Blum, that's L-E-O-N-B-L-U-M, and other French officials. According to Carmen Khalil's Bad Faith, A Forgotten History of Family, Fatherland, and Vichy France, Marat penned numerous articles calling for Blum to be lynched, or Blum to be lynched, and shot in the back, and have his throat slit. Parenthetically, Léon Blum was actually, for a short time, the head of the Social Front, which was in the governing seat of France for a short period of time. It was the focal point of various coup attempts, such as the Cagoulard coup that we have discussed in a number of different programs. Continuing with the article, Marat blamed World War II on the Jews, faulting them for the German occupation of France. Quote, "The barbarous occupation of 1940 would not have taken place without the Jews of 1939, without their filthy war, the war they undertook and they declared. Our occupiers were introduced by them. It was the Jews who launched us into catastrophe," he wrote, according to the 2001 article by Khalil in The New Statesman. Khalil, by the way, is C-A-L-L-I-L. Khalil also noted that Marat's newspaper supported the Nazis and, quote, "named names, hunted down enemies, and called for hostages, résistants, Jews, and Gaullists to be shot," unquote. In his political column during the war, Marat wrote that, quote, "if the death penalty is not sufficient to put a stop to the Gaullists, members of their families should be seized as hostages and executed," unquote. At the end of the war, Marat was sentenced to life in prison for complicity with the Nazis. He reportedly cited his conviction, quote, "Dreyfus's revenge," unquote. Due to his failing health, he was released from prison shortly before his death in 1952. According to Politico, Bannon approvingly cited Marat's distinction between what the French philosopher called the real country of the people and the legal country, unquote, led by government officials. Marat put Jews in the latter category, according to Brown, and referred to all Jews as foreigners. This further fascist influence on Stephen Bannon, Charles Marat, was head of L'Action Française, and a doctrinaire anti-Semite, and also a Nazi collaborator. What is not really, it exists in the background of the discussion, but that is the powerful pro-German, pro-Nazi fascist fifth column that existed in France. There had been powerful underground fascist movements in France, such as the aforementioned Cagoulard or Hooded Ones, the Croix de Feu or Cross of Fire, and they had a number of different publications toward which they gravitated, such as L'Action Française. This fifth column, in turn, was a administrative and street-level manifestation of a profound international corporate link between French steelmakers and ironmakers and some of the German steel and ironmakers and the allied coal interests in the Saar region of Germany, the French Comité des Forges, and many of the Saar industrialists and other steelmakers in Germany, I should say, were allied with their French counterparts through various international cartel agreements, and ultimately that manifested as not only an economic fifth column, but a political fifth column as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
In For the Record 372, from the fall of 2002, we discussed not only the corporate fifth column in France, its alignment with many of the German industrialists and financiers who helped to back the armies that marched into France, but how the French cartel partners of the German coal and steel producers ultimately helped to get their German compatriots off of any legal hook for any of the things that they had done. After discussing that economic fifth column and comparing what the results of that were, and discussing the comparison between the economic fifth column in France prior to and during World War II, and the powerful corporate and economic alliances between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia that was among the factors that eclipsed the reality of the September 11th attacks. We discussed the fifth column movement in France, how it torpedoed the French military resistance toward the Germans, and the role of the officers in the German military, or the French military, I should say, who referenced people like Charles Marat and the publications like L'Action Française. So from the fall of 2002, here is an excerpt of For the Record 372. There is a brief misstatement in which I identified this as 371. So again, from For the Record 372, the fall of 2002.
We're going to take a look now at a book called Triumph of Treason. This was authored by Pierre Cot, last name C-O-T, who was the French Minister of Aviation under Léon Blum's Social Front for the French government. Triumph of Treason by Pierre Cot was published by Ziff Davis Publishing Company and copyright 1944. So this book was published before the end of World War II. Now, in this book, Pierre Cot, who again was the French Minister of Aviation and who struggled against some of the forces of French reaction to modernize the French Air Force and to put the French military on a competitive basis with the Nazis, unfortunately, as we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M60, available from Spitfire, many of the more powerful interests in France not only were connected to some of their German counterparts, and again we took a look at the De Wendels running of interference for the German Rockling family in both World Wars. They helped to spare Rockling interests in World War I while the two countries were at war, and then the Rocklings got key contracts to help make the Maginot Line. What we're going to talk about here, courtesy of Pierre Cot and Triumph of Treason, is the rapid capitulation of the French military in World War II. This due to the activities in part of a powerful fascist fifth column in France. And I believe that there is a similar fifth column in the United States, marrying American fascist elements to Islamo-fascist elements. And I believe, in turn, the structural relationship between American oil companies and Saudi Arabia is in some ways analogous to the relationship between the French heavy industrialists and their counterparts in Germany. That relationship translated into the onto the battlefield as follows. Again, Pierre Coe writing in Triumph of Treason from 1944. Talking about the condemning of the social front of Léon Blum for the rapid collapse of the French army, and this condemning being done by the very fascist elements that had subverted the French army, Pierre Coe writes as follows. First of all, it was necessary to preserve the honor of the army, unquote. General Weygand thundered these words like a command. He was one of the French generals who would basically help to deliver the French to the Germans. Speaking of Weygand, he used unconsciously the same terms that leaders of the French army had invoked during the Dreyfus affair to prevent public opinion from discovering their criminal mistakes. Preserve the honor of the army to French military men is to secure by every means, including those outlawed by moral law and the penal code, the defense of the military establishment. This again against charges of having basically blown it in the war against the Germans in World War II. Continuing. The question of the responsibility of military leaders in the military defeat of France either had to be evaded or posed in distorted terms. To preserve the honor of the army, unquote, the scapegoats of the defeat had to be chosen from among the political personnel of the Third Republic. Again, that was the Blum government of which Coe was part. Continuing. In truth, at the end of June 1940, the question of who was responsible was in everyone's mind. In the 2 weeks preceding the armistice, I was in touch with the crowd of refugees that slowly and painfully followed the road southward. In the offices of the prefects, in the town halls, restaurants, and relief centers, I listened to many conversations, received many confidences, heard many opinions. Opinions differed on governmental policy, but all agreed in denouncing the blunders of the French general staff. The country was unanimous not against Blum, Daladier, or even against Laval, Pierre-Étienne Flandin, Georges Bonnet, or Jacques Doriot, but against the generals who had been incapable of understanding the conditions of modern warfare and who were guilty of not knowing the rudiments of their profession. Quote, just as before 1914 they had prepared for the war of 1870, the people said, before 1939 they prepared for the war of 1914, unquote. And again, I believe there were bureaucratic blunders of the most profound sort, which obviously were evident in the failure to prevent September 11th. I also believe that, as was the case in France, there was active subversion of the investigation into bin Laden and the possibility that the attacks could have been prevented by a fascist fifth column. Some of the undermining of the anti bin Laden effort was due to the economic efforts within the context of the structural relationship, but within the context of that structural relationship, domestic and European and Islamo-fascist elements, I believe, are at work to subvert and destroy the United States. Continuing. The severest condemnation of the French general staff came from the soldiers themselves. Lost on the roads in pursuit of dispersed divisions and phantom regiments, thrown together with the refugees whose uncertainties and anxieties they shared, the men in uniform cursed the conduct of their own leaders. They repeated that they had never been schooled in the techniques of modern warfare, especially in the combined use of tanks and aviation, and they were amazed at the ineptness of their own commanders in the battles of May and June. They asked why the Meuse and Seine bridges had not been blown up before the arrival of German motorized columns, why Paris had not been defended street by street as the Spanish Republicans had defended Madrid and as the Russians were to defend Stalingrad. And they wanted to know why more than half of the tanks and airplanes had been left in the rear, in Orléans, Toulouse, Lyon, North Africa, instead of being massed for a counterattack that might have changed everything on the battlefield. They knew that the depot were bursting with the cannon, airplanes, and equipment they had needed. One began to hear quoted the disturbing remarks with which General Weygand had tried to persuade the cabinet to ask for an armistice. That he needed his tanks to master the revolutionary elements at home if it should become necessary. That is to say, the commander-in-chief of the French army preferred fighting French workers to throwing all of his forces against the French troops. The soldiers praised the bravery of certain leaders, Giraud, Lestien, de Gaulle, Lucien, Delattre de Tassigny, and many others, but they declared that most of the officers had been the first to flee. Quote, "They left in automobiles, and we left on foot," they said, talking about those officers. "Faithful followers of L'Action Française, Je Suis Partout, Gringoire, and the other French fascist newspapers, which had said in various forms during the winter that this was a democratic war and consequently did not interest them." And speaking again about the rage against the generals in France, by June of 1940, not one man, unless he were directly involved, would have defended the general staff. The most indulgent spoke of incompetence, the most severe of betrayal, and the latter were in the majority. Moreover, available information about war prisoners indicated that these unfortunates were still more bitter against their leaders than were their comrades in France. Their anger was legitimate. It was inexplicable, after all, that the general staff, after deciding to abandon Paris and thus opening the east to the Germans, had not ordered the troops which occupied the Maginot Line to fall back toward the south. More than 1 million men, the best of the French army, were caught in the German trap, a disaster which could have been prevented by an order from General Weygand. And again, it was the opinion of many that, quite simply, the French general staff, in line with the interests of elements like the de Vendels and the Comité de Forge, were really much more enamored of Hitler than of their own countrymen, whose interests they, if not actively opposed, whose potential power they feared. After the Vichy fascist collaborationist government was set up in France on behalf of elements like the de Vendels and promptly dropping the 40-year sentence against the Roquelings, as we looked at in Side 1, the blame for the defeat was deflected away from the fascist Fifth Column and onto the social front of Léon Blum. Continuing with Triumph of Treason, by its composition, the government of Vichy was representative not of the French people, but of the general staff. Its first cabinets were headed by Maréchal Pétain, the spiritual leader of the French army, the man who had played the most important part in the preparation of the war and in the formation of the general staff. And these cabinets were composed largely of members of the general staff, General Weygand, General Pujol, Admiral Dalin, General Hunsinger, General Bergeret, and Admiral Platon. As the French proverb says, the wolves do not eat each other, skipping down. To their astonishment, the French people saw Maréchal Pétain slowly fill the most important posts of authority in local, departmental, and central administrations with men who had taken part in the fascist Cagoulard plot of 1938, with those who had repeated the infamous refrain, "Rather Hitler than Léon Blum," and even with some of those who before or during the war had been arrested for treasonable domestic and foreign activities. The people were applying to the government the old proverb, "Tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are." They were alarmed to see Vichy employ for its most delicate missions Ferdinand de Brinon, Jean Montigny, Jean Goy, Jean Lucher, and Gaston Henri A., members of the Comité France-Allemagne, an organization which before the war had been inspired and financed by Otto Abetz, after 1940, Hitler's ambassador in Paris. They learned with fury that on the night of the armistice, when France was in mourning, Frenchmen and French women of the aristocracy, high finance, and industry had drunk at Bordeaux to the defeat which had rid them of the nightmare of democracy and of the popular front. The people understood that the Fifth Column in France, as in Spain, had opened the door to Hitler's agents and they watched with awe the agents of the Fifth Column become masters of France, the France of Pétain, Végan, and Laval. And still later, this fascist Fifth Column, which was to subvert France in the early stages of World War II, and which in turn was able to operate within some of the structural relationships between French heavy industry and German heavy industry. And again, I believe there is a similar an analogous Fifth Column at work in this country, in which domestic fascists, the heirs in some cases to some of the imports of the Crusade for Freedom, and Islamo-fascists associated not only with the power elite in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, but also with the power elite in the United States, as exemplified in the Talat Otman, Abdullah Baksh, George Bush connection. I believe a similar Fifth Column is subverting the United States today, and I think that in the event of another disastrous terrorist incident, we should consider very carefully what the future of the country is going to be and just how much we wish to tolerate from interests like Saudi Arabia. Turning to discussion of the French Fifth Column in Triumph of Treason, again, this book was written in 1944. Pierre Coe writes, "The activity of the Fifth Column will not be considered by historians as a special phenomenon of French public life only, but as an integral part of fascism. The Fifth Column has appeared wherever fascism is trying to gain a foothold. It was at work in Spain, Austria, and Czechoslovakia before it turned up in France, and there are Fifth Columns in the United States, India, and Latin America. By Fifth Column, I do not mean only spies and licensed traitors. The Fifth Column includes all who, by accepting fascist doctrines or methods, become the conscious or unconscious accomplices of a foreign power. Treason and complicity have their degrees and nuances. The general staff of the Fifth Column consists principally of ambitious men who try to seize power by destroying or paralyzing the democratic system. The body of the Fifth Column is composed of people who think they are saving their country from the communist menace or British imperialism, and who do not even know in whose favor their actions are operating. Through hate of the popular front, good Frenchmen or men who consider themselves such served Hitler gratuitously by doing work to which they would never have consented had they been offered payment. Why? Because they detested the Republic and democracy more than they loved France. They accepted the idea of the defeat as a necessary evil which permitted them to rid France of the democratic system and to keep in power in the neighboring countries the fascist dictators whom they considered solely capable of maintaining any sort of order in Europe. They afterwards became unconscious collaborators of these very same dictators. They thought they were doing their duty in letting Hitler free France from the Judeo-Masonic influence and Europe from the communist peril. These people, who had never read Marx, considered the Marxist danger, unquote, more immediate than the Hitlerian danger. They preferred the risks of an entente with a victorious Hitler to the risks of a democratic victory that would cause the collapse of the fascist dictators in Europe. Considering Hitler in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, and Franco in Spain as knights of an anti-Bolshevist crusade, they became precursors and later partisans of collaboration with Hitler's new order," unquote. Skipping down in Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe, "Enough evidence has been published already to prove that France was stabbed in the back by those who saw in Hitler the new Saint George who would slay the communist dragon." Again, I'm not suggesting this is a precise analogy, but I believe we have something similar in the United States, which is deathly afraid of democracy and which is actively working on behalf not only of an underground Reich, but which is using some of the structural relationships within the petroleum industry and Saudi Arabia to effect what ultimately will be either the destruction or subjugation of the United States. Continuing with Pierre Coe's discussion of the Fifth Column in France, "When Pierre Lazareff, former editor-in-chief of Paris Soir, the French newspaper with the widest circulation, reports royalists as saying, 'We need the defeat to wipe out the Republic,' when Elie Bois, former editor of the Petit Parisien, the most influential political newspaper, reports great industrialists as admitting to him during the winter of 1939-1940 that a plot had been organized to replace the democratic regime by a government of authority, unquote, and that this plot presupposed a Nazi victory. We have every reason to accept their affirmations, which tally so perfectly with the events themselves. Skipping down again. France received no exceptional treatment from Hitler and fascism. A general plan coordinated the activity of the fifth columns all over the world. All were recruited from the same circles and had the same social and political composition. The object was the same everywhere, to divide and unnerve public opinion, weaken the resistance of the regime, and prepare a governmental group ready to execute a fascist coup d'etat at a moment of trouble or confusion. The methods were the same everywhere. Cultivation of the seeds of disunity which normally exist among free men and in free countries, exaggeration and inflammation of all racial and religious conflicts, all class rivalries, all political antagonisms, gradual conversion of opposition and dissent into hate, creation of an atmosphere of civil war. The means used were the same everywhere. Campaigns of calumny against the democratic leaders capable of opposing fascism, Blum in France, Roosevelt in the United States, the development of anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is the first manifestation of racism and contains in petto the whole doctrine of Hitler, use of the fear of communism among the middle classes, because anti-communism is the best way to prevent the union of all anti-fascist forces. This last device has been the most efficacious. The fear of communism has become, in Europe and American politics of recent years, a much more important factor than communism itself. Now again, Pierre Coe was writing in 1944.
Now begin from For the Record 372 from the fall of 2002.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Well, we're going to move now from France to contemporary Italy, where the five-star movement, again, a quote, populist, unquote, movement, is doing very well in the polls and may be poised to come to power in Italy. Reuters story by Crispian, C-R-I-S-P-I-A-N, Balmer, capital B-A-L-M as in Mary E-R. This from Reuters of March 21st of 2017. Italy's five-star builds strong lead over Renzi's, R-E-N-Z-I's, PD in polls. Italy's anti-establishment five-star movement, benefiting from a split in the ruling Democratic Party and divisions in the center-right, has built a strong lead over its rivals, an opinion poll showed on Tuesday. The Ipsos poll in Corriere della Sera newspaper put the five-star, which wants a referendum on Italy's membership of the euro, on 32.3%, its highest ever reading, and 5.5 points ahead of the PD, which was on 26.8%. The survey suggests that the five-star is likely to emerge as the largest group in national elections due by early 2018, although it might struggle to create a government given its stated aversion to forging coalitions. More about the five-star movement. This from The Nation magazine of August 30th of 2016. Article by Frederica, F-R-E-D-E-R-I-K-A, Randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. Italy's five-star movement may be the heir to Mussolini's fascists. Subheaded, the party harps on the messianic themes of redemption for the betrayed, is allied with Britain's far-right UKIP, and is controlled with an iron hand by leader Beppe Grillo of the UKIP, by the way, headed up, formerly headed up by Nigel Farage, Once again, a networking element with Stephen Bannon and with Donald Trump, and the beneficiary of Cambridge Analytica's Nazified AI. Skipping down in the story, talking about MI5, and note again the messianic theme of redemption for the betrayed, something that is common to various fascist movements, and part of that redemption is the demonization and perceived revenge against the ubiquitous other, be that other Jews or Muslims or Christians in the case of Islamic fascism. There's always somebody else, and those people are responsible. So, by extension, if you get those people, then you have become, then you have achieved a righteous vengeance. Skipping down. This is again from The Nation, 8/30/2016. A look at the specific policy promises of the five-star movement turns up a hodgepodge of the petty and the grand, a long wish list that seems to have been compiled from the kind of web survey dear to party strategist Casadegio. He died in April of this year, aged 61, of a brain tumor. Note that this is compiled from the kind of web survey dear to the party strategist. Assess that against the background of Robert Mercer's AI that he developed with IBM, and that is at the core of Cambridge Analytica, and uses what is in effect a Nazified artificial intelligence and big data, especially data compiled from Facebook, to basically game the political landscape. Continuing. Thus, under economy, unquote, the five-star movement program calls for both vigorous debt reduction and, quote, ceilings on executive pay in publicly traded and state-controlled companies, unquote, and favors local production, unquote, and nonprofits, unquote, as well as guaranteed unemployment benefits. By the way, I agree in principle with all of those things. One of the things this reminds me of is the Bernie Sanders movement. More about that next week. I agree with many, if not most, of the policy positions of Bernie Sanders, but I think at its core, that movement is based on illusion, and I suspect many of the Sanders people may ultimately wind up being the younger ones, that is, the equivalent of the Wandervogel from pre-Nazi Germany. More about that later. Actually, in weeks to come, I should say, after discussing again the various worthy goals of the official policy positions taken by the five-star movement, again, based on web surveys, very important. Alongside, then, Ms. Randall then continues, alongside all these good intentions, however, there is no trace of the hard choices about how to stimulate a repressed economy that any governing party would necessarily have to make. No mention of employment inequality or EU-imposed austerity. Under, quote, transport, unquote, the program calls for more bike paths and an improved rail system to discourage automobile use, but there is no mention of spending on infrastructure under economy, unquote, or of how to accomplish all these good deeds and pay a minimum income while slashing the debt. Nor does the program have any indications on foreign policy. The five-star movement is anti-Europe, and its Euro MPs are aligned with the far-right xenophobes of Britain's UK Independence Party in the EU Parliament, at least until Britain finally leaves the Union. It's a program rich in magical thinking, in short. Again, that is something that is many of these fascist, alt-right populist slash ultra-nationalist slash paleo-conservative, anything but fascist and Nazi. Can't use those words. It's something many of them have in common. And I think there are some very real dangers, too, lurking within the admittedly worthy, albeit unworkable, political platform of Bernie Sanders. However, more about Sanders in weeks to come. Skipping down in the story. In recent years, prodded by Casaleggio, the five-star movement has embraced anti-immigrant and anti-regulatory positions dear to the small business owners they hope to draw into the movement. When the government of Matteo Renzi was finally poised to pass a law on civil unions giving gays long-needed rights, a measure hotly contested in a country occupied by the Vatican, the five-star movement suddenly withdrew support and members were told to vote their consciences, thus dooming the most controversial plank, the one allowing gay couples to adopt. The promised direct democracy, unquote, of online voting candidates and major five-star decisions are decided by a vote on the Griot blog site, has time and again brought accusations of fraudulent vote counting. Again, the promised, quote, direct democracy, unquote, of online voting candidates and major five-star decisions are decided by a vote on the Griot blog site has time and again brought accusations of fraudulent vote counting. By many accounts, the party is fragmented, held together by draconian measures from the top, like the penalty of 150,000 euros that local representatives, including Mayor Raggi, are contractually obliged to pay the party should they stray from the agreed action policy line. Skipping down again. But in truth, if any party resembles the one Benito Mussolini was building with the support of bitter World War I veterans in 1919 and 1920, it is the five-star movement. There is the same messianic theme of redemption for the betrayed, in today's case, citizens betrayed by their corrupt and spendthrift governors. Sound familiar? The same mixture of ideas hastily borrowed from right and left. Lest we forget, Mussolini was a socialist before he was a fascist. The same dictatorial grip at the top applied to keep a sprawling movement together. For the only issue that really unites the five-star movement's adherents is scorn for politics and politicians. That wholesale plague on all their houses condemnation of a political class is rather difficult to reconcile with public office, as some five-star members elected to local government or parliament in Rome have learned to their dismay. Again, as things stand now, they are poised to come to power in Italy. Moving now to Slovakia, this from the New York Times of March 19th, 2017. Article by Rick Lyman, L-Y-M-A-N. Once in the shadows, Europe's neo-fascists are re-emerging. This is about the neo-fascist party, really neo belongs in quotes, of Robert S-V-E-C, I'm not sure how that is pronounced. Skipping down. Head bowed in reverence, Robert Svejp, I'll pronounce it, gently placed a bouquet of blood-red flowers at the foot of the only known statue of Josef Tiso, T-I-S-O, Slovakia's wartime fascist leader in a weedy monument park known as the Pantheon of Slovak Historical Figures. For years, Mr. Svejp's neo-fascist cultural organization, the Slovak Revival Movement, was a tiny fringe group. But now his crowds are growing as 200 people recently gathered with him to celebrate the country's fascist past and call fascist-era greetings, Nastraz, capital N-A, capital S-T-R-A-Z, or On the Guard. Mr. Svejp is so emboldened that he is transforming his movement into a political party with plans to run for parliament. You are ours and we will be forever yours, Mr. Svejp said at the foot of the statue, having declared this as the year of Josef Tiso dedicated to rehabilitating the image of the former priest and Nazi collaborator who was hanged as a war criminal in 1947. Once in the shadows, Europe's neo-fascists are stepping back out. More than three-quarters of a century after Nazi boots stormed through Central Europe, and two decades since a neo-Nazi resurgence of skinheads and white supremacists unsettled the transition to democracy. Skipping down. before pro-fascist sentiments were kept hidden, said Gabriel Sipos, SIPOS, director of Transparency International Slovakia. Quote, parents were told their children, you cannot say this at school, unquote. Now, you can say things in the public space that you couldn't say before. Parenthetically, that's why I talk about an underground. One of the reasons I talk about an underground. Right, continuing, skipping down. Now, extremists and fascists are part of the system, said Grigorij Mezeznikov, M-E-S-E-Z-I-N-I-K-O-V, president of the Institute for Public Affairs of Liberal Research Group. And speaking of Marian Kotleba, who's our People's Party, our Slovakia, once wore uniforms similar to Josip Tiso's fascist cadre. Skipping down. The underlying message of groups like Mr. Kotleba's and Mr. Schweitz's has not shifted. Slovakia was better off under a fascist government. Something very dark and very troubling from the past is coming back, Mr. Havran said, H-A-V-R-A-N. They feel they are fighting for something very pure, something very old and sacred. A few years ago, they were ashamed to talk about it. Now, they are proud. Skipping down again. Mr. Kotleba's party has been especially effective on social media. Think Cambridge Analytica. Think Steve Bannon. Think Robert Mercer. Think about the Nazi AI. Continuing, beginning again. Mr. Kotleba's party has been especially effective on social media with more than 140 interconnected Facebook pages. And a local retiree, Jan Benčić, B-E-N-C-I-K, 68, began blogging to expose the country's neo-fascists. His name appeared on a list of, quote, opponents of the state, unquote. One of the alt-right figures who has received a lot of publicity and who was in the Trump camp and held a rally a few blocks from the White House shortly after Trump's election, in which he quoted in the original German from Nazi or Third Reich propaganda, and his followers then saluted Heil Trump. That is a guy named Richard Spencer, who has now launched a new alt-right website.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
From Slate magazine of January 17th of 2017, article by Osita, O-S-I-T-A, Mavenu, N-W-A-V-E-N-U, Richard Spencer and his alt-right buddies launch a new website. On Monday, Richard Spencer, New Jersey Institute of Technology lecturer Jason Georgiani, J-O-R-J-A-N-I, and Swedish new right figure Daniel Friberg, or Friberg, F-R-I-B-E-R-G, launched altright.com, a site aimed at bringing together the best writers and analysts from alt-right in North America, Europe, and around the world. Friberg is a veteran of this, by the way, skipping down. As of now, most of the site's content is recycled material from Freiberg's Arctos Publishing House, Spencer's other publication, Radix Journal, the alt-right online media network Red Ice, and Occidental Dissent, a white nationalist blog run by altright.com's news editor, Hunter Wallace. Now, Daniel Freiberg and his Arctos Publishing House basically are part of the same Swedish fascist milieu as Carl Lundstrom, who not only helped, was the chief financier of the Pirate Bay website on which WikiLeaks held forth, but is part of the same international fascist milieu as Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, unquote, one of Julian Assange's top aides, a doctrinaire Holocaust denier, and someone who has been handling WikiLeaks operations for Russia. And for the record, 732, we went into some of the institutions in Sweden with whom Carl Lundstrom was allied, and that includes the publishing house Nordic Publishers, or Nordiska Forlaget. My Swedish is non-existent. Nordiska Forlaget. From Realtid SE from March 10th of 2000. 6, by Peter Carlson, this again from For the Record 732. The goal, take over all piracy. And reading from the Google translation, Lundstrom has made no secret of his sympathy for the xenophobic groups, and last year was his name with the customer code of the Nazi publishing house Nordic Publishers. Again, or Nordiska Forlaget. That is the outfit from which basically the Daniel Schreiber operations have evolved. Continuing with that Google translation, the publisher, that's Nordic Publishers, supports the Nazi demonstration in Salem and invited the Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke for a lecture tour in Sweden. And from the Expo, that is the anti-fascist magazine that was founded by the late Stig Larsson and was called the Millennium in the movies The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, and The Girl Who Played with Fire, the very popular movies made from the even more, well, certainly very popular Stig Larsson novels. From the Expo magazine, again using the Google translation, January of 2014, Right-Wing Public Education by Maria Pia Cabero, C-A-B-E-R-O. When NF, that's Nordic Publishers, was discontinued in 2010, then was founded the publisher Arctos by basically the same people. Arctos publishes new right-inspired literature, and Chief Executive Officer Daniel Freiberg, now working with Richard Spencer, who was the driving force in the NF, has played a key role in the establishment of ideas. That should come as no surprise. So what we have, basically, is one of Richard Spencer's partners, the Swedish fascist, alt-right figure Daniel Freiberg, now, by the way, living in Hungary, interestingly enough, being part of the same Swedish fascist, alt-right milieu, as Carl Lundstrom. Turning to Japan, from the GermanForeignPolicy.com blog that feeds along the lower right-hand side of the website, from Partners at the Pacific, I think they really mean that that's a translation from the German, in the Pacific, March 20th of 2017, talking about networking between the Japanese and German power elites, skipping down, right-wing populism from above about Japan. Japan, with which Germany is seeking closer economic and military cooperation, has taken a sharp nationalist course. This course is generally associated with Abe becoming prime minister. Abe, who arrived in Hanover yesterday, quote, is anticipating in Japan what right-wing populists dream of in Europe, unquote, a leading German daily recently noted. With his visit to the Yasukuni Shrine, which honors some World War II war criminals, he is promoting a nationalist transformation of the state. He is permitting the growing falsification of history, and he is responsible for the increased patronizing of the media. As a result, Japan slipped from 22nd down to 72nd on the World Press Freedom Index issued by Reporters Without Borders, unquote. Observers note that the Nippon Kaigi, or Japan Conference, a nationalist lobby organization, has gained significant influence. Of the 722 Japanese parliamentarians, 289 are members of it, and 13 of the 19 ministers and Prime Minister Abe are in close contact with the Nippon Kaigi. Nippon Kaigi says of itself that it is striving to strengthen the empire, that would be the Japanese empire, loosen the separation of state and religion, upgrade the traditional family and gender roles, promote the country's militarization, and end critical consideration of Japan's crimes during World War II. Right-wing populism in Japan, quote, is a process guided from above, unquote, particularly pushed by the country's elite, according to Gabriela Vogt, V-O-G-T, Japanologist at Hamburg University. We've spoken about that most well in a number of shows, most recently, For the Record 813. Recapping an item from For the Record 18, this from the Daily Beast of September 26th of 2014 by Jack Edelstein, A-D-E-L-S-T-E-I-N, and Angela Erica Kubo, E-R-I-K-A-K-U-B-O. For top politicians in Japan, crime doesn't pay, but hate crime does, unquote. And skipping down in this, talking about some of the Japanese cabinet ministers. Again, 13 of 19 positions occupied by the Nippon Kaigi, K-A-I-G-I. I am sure I am mispronouncing that, but that's the best I can do. What we're looking at here is a woman named Tomomi, T-O-M-O-M-I, Inada, I-M-A-D-A. And by the way, we're going to be taking this up at length in a program in the near future. Skipping down. According to the magazine Sunday Mainichi, M-A-I-N-I-C-H-I, Ms. Tomomi Inada, I-M-A-D-A, Minister of the Cool Japan Strategy, also received donations from Masaki and other Zeto Kukai associates. That is a militant anti-Korean xenophobic group in Japan. Continuing, apparently racism is cool in Japan. Ms. Inada made news earlier this month after photos circulated of her and another female in the new cabinet posing with a neo-Nazi party leader. Again, Inada made news earlier this month after photos circulated of her and another female in the new cabinet posing with a neo-Nazi party leader. Both denied knowing the neo-Nazi, but later were revealed to have contributed blurbs for an advertisement praising the out-of-print book Hitler's Election Strategy. Vice Prime Minister Taro Aso, who is also the finance minister of Japan, is also a longtime admirer of Nazi political strategy and has suggested that Japan follow the Nazi party template to sneak constitutional changes past the public. Skipping down. In August, Japan's ruling party, which put Abe into power, organized a working group to discuss laws that would restrict hate crime, although the new laws will probably also be used to clamp down on anti-nuclear protests outside the Diet building. The Diet of Diet is a Japanese parliament. Continuing. Of course, it is a little worrisome that Sanae Takeichi, T-A-K-A-I-C-H-I, who was supposed to oversee the anti-hate crime project, is the other female cabinet minister who was photographed with a neo-Nazi leader and who is a fan of Adolf Hitler. So in addition to the former Cool Japan Minister, that's actually a post, cabinet post in Japan. In addition to Taro Aso, both Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, Sanae, S-A-N-A-E, Takeichi, who was supposed to head up the Anti-Hate Crimes Project, was photographed with a neo-Nazi leader and is a fan of Hitler. Classic case of the fox watching the hen house. Now, of Tomomi Inada, she has moved up in life. She is no longer the Cool Japan Minister. Now, she is the Defense Minister of Japan. From, this is a Reuters story, Dateline Tokyo. It's by Elaine Lies, or Lies, L-I-E-S, and Kayushi. Kayoshi, K-I-Y-L-S-H-I, Takanaka, T-A-K-E-N-A-K-A, August 3rd, 2016. Japan's Prime Minister picks hawkish Defense Minister for new cabinet, vows economic recovery. Skipping down. New Defense Minister Tomomi Inada, that's the admirer of Hitler who wrote a promotional blurb for a book, Hitler's Election Strategy. New Defense Minister Tomomi Inada, previously the ruling party policy chief, shares Abe's goal of revising the post-war pacifist constitution, which some conservatives consider a humiliating symbol of Japan's World War II defeat. She also regularly visits Tokyo's Yasukuni Shrine for War Day. And again, she is now defense minister. More about Tomomi Inada, Taro Azo, and what is going on in Japan in a future program. Moving south to India, where the BJP is now in power. Narendra Modi's BJP is a cat's paw for the RSS, the Hindu nationalist slash fascist political party that murdered Mahatma Gandhi and with whom, among others, Tulsi Gabbard, the former deputy DNC chief and the big Bernie Sanders backer, viewed with favor by Steve Bannon, interviewed by Donald Trump for a cabinet position, has been networking. This fascist political party, again, Hindu nationalist in orientation, has been demonizing Muslims, and after an electoral victory in Uttar Pradesh, India's largest state and with a great many poor people, in which Modi was successfully able to promote himself as one of the hoi polloi, so to speak, because he rose from common working class background to being powerful. An editorial in today's New York Times, March 23rd of 2017, actually, unusually for the New York Times, hit the nail on the head. Mr. Modi's embrace of Hindu extremists, skipping down. On Sunday, Mr. Modi revealed his hand, emboldened by a landslide victory in recent elections in India's largest state, Uttar Pradesh. His party named a firebrand Hindu cleric yogi, Adityanath, as the state leader. Of Adityanath. He has made a political career of demonizing Muslims, thundering against such imaginary plots as love jihad, the notion that Muslim men connive to water down the overwhelming Hindu majority by seducing Hindu women. He defended a Hindu mob that murdered a Muslim man in 2015 on the suspicion that his family was eating beef. Skipping down. Should Mr. Adityanath fail to deliver on his promises, there is every fear that he and Mr. Modi's party will resort to deadly Muslim baiting to stay in power. Yes, indeed. There will be links to some of the past discussions of the RSS. This concludes For the Record program number 951, Fascism. 2017 World Tour. This is being recorded on March 23rd of 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.